Welcome to What She Said on 105.9 The Region. I'm your host, Candace Sampson. Happy Easter to those celebrating, and for everyone else, enjoy your long weekend. Woo! I always love the Easter long weekend, not just for the festivities, but also because it heralds a series of long weekends we get monthly now until November. In other news, I'm excited to share that I'm off to Ireland next week to explore the wild Atlantic Way, so there won't be a show, but I do promise to return with a treasure trove of amazing interviews, so make sure to tune in then. But for today, I've got a packed show with essential insights you won't want to miss. Here's what's coming up. We're kicking things off with a deep dive into the world of omega-3 fatty acids, those crucial elements of our diet that, surprisingly, 2 out of 5 Canadians are missing out on. To guide us through the importance of omega-3s and how to ensure we're getting enough, I'm joined by naturopathic Dr. Colleen Hartwick as part of What She Said's ongoing series with New Roots Herbal. Anne Brody is back with the latest in entertainment, bringing us the 6th and possibly best remake of Patricia Highsmith's book, The Talented Mr. Ripley, starring Andrew Scott on Netflix, Disney Plus's new femme-centric series, Renegade Nell, and the return of Tina Fey's Girls 5 Eva. Anne's insights are sure to add some cinematic flair to your week. As we get set to usher in Earth Month, it's a good time to reflect on our environmental impact and the choices we make in our daily lives. Dr. Melissa Lem, a family physician and president of the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, sheds light on the hidden health risks of gas usage in our homes. From the dangers of asthma and cancer to the perils of carbon monoxide poisoning, we're exploring the unseen hazards of gas appliances and discussing healthier alternatives for heating and cooking. Family history can be a tangled web with secrets buried deep enough to shape generations. Gwen Harvey, entrepreneur turned storyteller, explores such narratives in her debut novel, The Acquisition of Elizabeth Grace. Set against the contrasting backdrops of England's aristocracy and Toronto's vibrancy, this novel examines the intricate mother-daughter dynamics, the shadows of the past, and the quest for truth. Gwen is here to share the inspiration behind this riveting coming-of-age story and the journey of uncovering family secrets. For teenagers, the fear of failure can be a formidable barrier, hindering their willingness to embrace new experiences or take risks. This critical phase in their lives is when parental support and guidance becomes invaluable. Allie Payne, our go-to expert on parenting teens, joins me to discuss strategies for helping your teens navigate and overcome their fear of failure. Stay with me for an hour packed with valuable insights and stories that promise to enlighten and entertain, right here on 105.9 The Region. In our first interview today, we're unpacking the world of omega-3 fatty acids and their vital role in our health. Surprisingly, 2 out of 5 Canadians aren't getting their fill of these essential fats. To help us understand the importance of omega-3s and how to make sure we're including enough in our diets, I'm joined by naturopathic Dr. Colleen Hartwick on behalf of New Roots Herbal. So let's get into it. Welcome back to What She Said, Dr. Hartwick.
Thank you so much for having me back. I'm happy to be here.
So we've known that omega-3s are important for a long time and that most of us are lacking in it. How much do we need daily?
Yeah, so sort of most recent stats from Statistics Canada, 40% of Canadians are not getting enough omega-3s either through diet or through supplementation. And so what you'll see is the low bar in terms of intake is 100 milligrams of omega-3s every day. I don't think that's quite enough. More up-to-date research is suggesting at least 500 milligrams combined of 2 important omega-3s, EPA and DHA. I would suggest that the daily dosage should actually be even higher than that.
Wow.
Okay. 1 gram a day or 1,000 milligrams.
All right. So obviously, it's really challenging for Canadians to get enough of omega-3s. Why is this the case?
I think in part, I mean, I know lots of my patients don't like to eat fish, and the best source of 2 important omega-3s, the EPA and DHA, comes predominantly from fish. So most Canadians, if they're not regular fish consumers, are not getting enough EPA and DHA. And they're not eating the plants that also contain some omega-3s, things like flaxseed, chia seeds, hemp seeds.
And fish, as you mentioned, is typically high in omega-3s, but there are some concerns with fish consumption. Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Absolutely. So some of your audience might already know, unfortunately, oceans are not pristine. And so there is the possibility, especially with either fish harvested on your own or perhaps if you're opting for supplements that are of a lower quality, the risk of contamination with heavy metals is real. So things like mercury, lead, cadmium have been found in fish as well as lower quality of fish oil supplements.
So supplements sound like the answer here, but not all supplements are created equally. So what should we be looking for when we're choosing an omega-3?
Yeah. So again, opting for a supplement, you want to look for brands where it's been tested by an arbitrary third party to make sure that there's purity. So minimal to low contamination of heavy metals, quality, as well as, you know, what the serving size is on the nutrition label is actually present within the soft gel. So looking for some sort of third party testing. And the gold standard right now seems to be the ISO 17025 accreditation. If you see that either on the product itself or you go to the company's website, there should be a certificate of analysis saying this is pure, it has low contamination, and what's on the label is actually present in the product.
So there's obviously health benefits that come along with this, or the government of Canada wouldn't be telling us how deficient we are in it. So what are the health benefits of omega-3?
I mean, for the sake of brevity, I won't go through all of them, but loosely, omega-3s are really important for helping to reduce inflammation. And we know more and more that inflammation plays a huge role in basically any and all, both acute and chronic health conditions. So again, some key benefits for omega-3s, reducing inflammation. So that could be less joint aches and pains, reducing the risk of cardiovascular disease, including heart attack and stroke, improvements in cognition, our brain and our eyes, which is an extension of the brain. It's mostly made of fat, and one important fat, DHA, structural for vision as well as for cognition. Again, the list goes on and on, but those are a few key benefits to the omegas.
And the omega-3 is not the only omega we should be talking about here, because there's omega-6, omega-7, and omega-9. That's a lot of omegas. And so do they all come from fish sources? Are they plant-based? How can we get those into our diet?
Yep. So each category of omega, this is getting into some chemistry stuff, so again, we'll try and keep it light, comes from various different sources. So things like omega-6, omega-7, but even some omega-3s, versions of omega-3s, come predominantly from plants. The omega-3s like DHA and EPA, again, these are the ones that we really want Canadians to be consuming, either through whole foods, i.e. fish, potentially algae as well, or through supplementation. Those typically come mostly from animal sources, although we can get DHA, EPA, two types of omega-3s from algae.
So let's talk about good fats, bad fats for a minute. I think this is a very confusing area for most people, myself included. Maybe you could give us a quick breakdown of some bad fats that should be possibly avoided in our diets, and then as we aim to increase good fats like omega-3.
Yeah. And so, and it's a little bit simplistic, but I think these simple rules are good to ascribe to. So the bad fats are considered bad because they're associated with more inflammation, and with that, a greater risk of things like cognitive decline, dementia, heart disease risk, various inflammatory conditions, you know, like inflammatory bowel disease or arthritis, for example. And so the bad fats include the omega-6 category of fats, which are predominantly pro-inflammatory, saturated fats, trans fats, those tend to get lumped into the bad fats category, again, because they can increase inflammation, heart disease risk, risk of cognitive decline. Why the omega-3s are considered the good fats is they're anti-inflammatory, and so are protective against those conditions associated with high levels of inflammation.
So I just want to make sure I have this straight. So olive oil, for example, is a good fat. We've heard this for a long time, but it's not an omega-3, right?
It'll have a little bit of omega-3. It predominantly has, it's an omega-9 fatty acid called oleic acid, which has been shown to be anti-inflammatory. as well. If you're getting a really good quality, like extra virgin olive oil, you notice it's got that bit of green pigment to it. That green pigment is reflective of the fact that there's lots of antioxidants present, as well as the anti-inflammatory omega-9 fatty acids.
When people go into their natural food health store, what should they consider when choosing omega-3 supplements? You mentioned a little bit about how it's tested. Is there anything else we should be looking for? And can we look for combinations of supplements that bring in omega-3, 6, 9? And do they offer enough, or is it better to go one single supplement for each?
Great question. So again, when we're in the health food store, the supplement shop, we're wanting to make a decision, again, looking for a brand where there has been some degree of third-party testing, just to make sure that, again, that product is going to be safe, effective, and the dosage on the label is actually what's going to be found either in the liquid or the soft gel. Beyond that, I see a lot of patients when they come in to see me, they're already on a 369, so an omega 369 product. And in general, Canadians are getting enough of the omega-6s and omega-9s through the types of plants that they're consuming, the types of oils that they're cooking with. And so really what the gap is on the whole in terms of the omega category is Canadians not getting enough omega-3s. So I generally find myself recommending getting an omega-3 exclusively and with the combination of the EPA and the DHA. EPA is really strongly anti-inflammatory. DHAs are really important structural fat to help us build a healthy brain and healthy eyes. So again, I'm typically advocating for omega-3 on its own because most Canadian diets have enough omega-6 and enough omega-9 present.
So we've touched on that fish is a major source of omega-3, but what can vegetarians and vegans do aside from supplements to get more of that omega-3 in their diets?
Yeah, so this is a tricky piece for our plant-based eaters because the EPA and DHA that I've mentioned quite a bit is found predominantly in animal sources and mainly in fish. Now, we can find reasonably high amounts of DHA as well as some EPA in algae. Beyond that, plant-based eaters are having to rely on a different type of omega-3 called ALA or alpha-linolenic acid. We're not very good at turning ALA into EPA and DHA. So for vegans, vegetarians, I would strongly encourage supplementation and opting for, they're really hard-lined on not having any animal products, opting for an algae-based omega-3 supplement.
Okay, here's my final question, because this one's a big one, I think, for a lot of people. Omega-3 supplements are typically huge, huge, and I don't have a problem swallowing those, but a lot of people just can't do it. So are there alternatives to these massive size of these supplements for other people who just maybe just can't do it?
Yeah. So this is maybe not universally, but a common response I get when I talk about, you know, fish oil omega-3 supplementation with patients is, oh my God, they're horse pills and how am I going to swallow that? So it just is the nature of the beast to get a sufficient dosage. You're either taking 14 soft gels a day or taking 2 or 3 larger soft gels. So in there, we do have a couple of options. So again, there's the soft gel route, but again, for anyone with difficulty swallowing, that's probably not the best option. You can also get liquid omega-3 supplements, both on the plant-based side as well as the fish oil side. And most of them are fairly palatable, usually add some degree of like lemon or orange flavor, you know, some rosemary and antioxidants. So the liquids are fairly palatable, especially far more so than they were, you know, years ago.
All right. Well, you know, I have omega-3 in my diet and but you've convinced me to be more diligent with it because I sometimes fall off the wagon with these supplements. So back to it for me right away. Dr. Hartwick, where can people connect with you and keep up with all you're doing?
Yeah, so I'm located on Vancouver Island. My business is Campbell River Naturopathic because I practice out of Campbell River, BC. So they could check out my website. I also have a Facebook and Instagram page, so welcome to check me out there. And hopefully at some point we'll have another conversation either about omega-3s or something else on the health front.
And just for people listening, you can find out more about omega-3s and all the omegas at newrootsherbal.com, as well as finding a natural health food store near you that carries New Roots Herbal.
More with Candace Sampson and What She Said coming up on 105.9 The Region. Welcome back to What She Said with Candace Sampson on 105.9 The Region.
It's time for Saturday Night at the Movies with Ann Brody, and we're diving deep into a remake this week, and the sixth remake, as a matter of fact, of Ripley.
That's right. Do you believe it? Patricia Highsmith's novel has been done so many times. This particular one on Netflix with Andrew Scott in the starring role is the best. It is absolutely chilling. I will warn you, though, the first couple of episodes move really slowly and it's like, what? And then boom, and you can't look away. And I guarantee you'll watch the whole thing in a day or two. It's phenomenal.
I have no doubt, but you know what? I have to tell you, I honestly thought it was a movie, and it wasn't until we were just talking that you said it was a series. And now I understand why it's better, because now they can really go into depth.
Yes. Yes.
Into indeed. The story and characters.
So now, Ripley, played by Andrew Scott, is hired by the father of Dickie Greenleaf, who's, you'll remember all these names, to go back to Italy and take his son away from a life of doing nothing, bring him back to be useful. Well, he goes to Italy. He meets his Dickie's girlfriend, Marge, who's played by Dakota Fanning. And, you know, they just have Italian meals and drink in the sun. That's about all they do. Well, Tom Ripley manages to worm his way into Dickie's affections. Dickie becomes quite dependent on him for amusement or to be a listening post. And Marge suspects something's fishy with Tom Ripley. And so Tom and Dickie go on a vacation together. Dickie disappears. He goes back, and I can't give away anything more. I mean, I know people know what the story is, but it is just made so brilliantly. It's black and white, elegant, beautiful, sort of more important than black and white. I don't know. But what struck me is that the black and white really emphasizes Ripley's black, blank eyes. And to me, it was just so chilling. So, I mean, you know, just bear with the first couple of slow episodes and then boom, you're cooked.
Yeah, I'm already invested. Just watching the trailer, I was invested in this, and seeing the black and white version really called to me for some reason. I don't know why.
It's so unusual and it's so beautiful. It's just beautiful to look at.
I'm really excited about the next one on Disney, which features a highway woman
named Nell.
Yeah.
It's called Renegade Nell. And this actress who I didn't know before at all, which is strange because it's English, Louisa Harlan, she plays the eldest of three daughters back in the 17th century. She and her father run a pub in a village. The local lord, who's a bit of a sadist, and his wastrel evil son, Thomas, actually kills his father when he cuts him off for being another wastrel. Huh, two Toms and two wastrels. life is funny. So Nell has to leave. She has to leave. She goes with her sisters. They ride off into the sunset. She is endowed with supernatural gifts given to her by a little genie called Billy Blind, little tiny thing. And she is able to fight off in the most spectacular manner any kind of enemy. And she meets so many. Number one, she's dangerous. Number two, she's mouthy. And that's what really gets her into trouble. But, you know, we love her. It's sort of a fantasy about women standing their ground against deadly odds. And it's just so thrilling and fun. And, you know, I think it's dramatic, it's funny, and Louisa Harland is just terrific. She has an unusual look, which I find is quite striking. And she makes a heck of a highwayman. Just good fun.
I loved the trailer, just made me smile and grin. But I will say she has come out of nowhere and she seems so great on screen. So I'm excited to see more from her. I think she's going to go far. So that's great. All right. What do you got for us next?
Girls Forever, now in its third season. Netflix is now running all three seasons. Now, I knew of its existence before, but it seemed from trailers and things that I saw really screechy, over the top, annoying. So I never bothered until this year. I love it. It's great. And it's from Tina Fey, so I should have expected it. But yeah, so it's about a girl band who in their 40s decide to regroup and hit the road again. They had one hit. They were one hit wonders. And so they're all older now. They have older people problems and obstacles. They know nothing about the business, but they set off on their own to manage themselves, do their own money, all of that. And it's so fun and inspiring and silly. And yes, it is loud, but it's very fun and very, very whimsical, silly, appealing, and well worth it. So I was a dope not to watch the first two seasons, but now you can all watch three seasons on Netflix.
Well, I'm going to, and I love and hate this actually, because we have so much content between all of these platforms now that we do miss a lot. And I had never heard of this series either until today. So yeah. I actually can't wait to look at it because it does look hilarious.
And Busy Phillips is in it too. She's the best one of them.
Yeah, I love her.
So, yes. And I just want to do a shout out to one of my favorite little shows called Is It Kate? And that's on Netflix. And that's beginning another season on the 29th. And it's coming back with, quote, bigger cakes, higher stakes, wilder bakes. But it can make you hungry, you know?
That show makes me laugh. All right, Anne, thanks so much. You've got all of these and more up on whatshesaidtalk.com, and we'll see you next week.
See you next week, Candace.
Things ain't what they used to be, no. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from north and south and east.
As we celebrate Earth Month this April, it's important to consider not just the environmental impact of our daily choices, but also their effects on our health. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Melissa Lem from the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment. We're discussing a pressing issue that many of us might not be aware of, the health risks associated with gas usage in our homes. With recent findings showing that nearly half of Canadians are unaware of the increased risk of asthma, cancer, and other health concerns due to gas usage, this conversation couldn't be more timely. Dr. Lem is here to shed light on the hidden dangers of gas appliances and what we could do to protect our families and the planet. Dr. Lem, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Candace. Great to be here.
Could you start by explaining why gas usage in homes is a growing concern for health professionals like yourself?
If you think about it, burning gas inside your home is like pulling up your vehicle exhaust to your kitchen and letting it go into the air and causing air pollution. Burning fossil fuels and breathing the fumes is in no situation good for our health. And there's a lot of research to back this up. There was a recent study released showing that 1 in 8 cases of childhood asthma in the US can be attributed to gas stove use. There's also research showing that children are 40% more likely to develop asthma symptoms when they live in a home with a gas stove. So not only are we filling our kitchens with air pollution when we burn gas, but we're also affecting the health of our families at the same time.
And, you know, children, elderly individuals with sort of pre-existing conditions are particularly vulnerable. Can you elaborate on how gas appliances can exacerbate health issues like asthma and allergies?
When you burn a fossil fuel like natural gas, which I think we should rebrand as methane gas because that's really what the majority of natural gas is inside our homes, it releases all kinds of toxins into the air. And the primary one that's been studied is called nitrogen dioxide. And it's been shown to be linked to all kinds of different health issues in kids because of its inflammatory effects and its toxic effects. So, for example, health effects of nitrogen dioxide in kids could, in fact, increase the risk of learning deficits. As I mentioned, it increases the risk of childhood asthma by irritating airways, and it also increases the susceptibility of kids to lung infections. We know we've just gotten through cold and flu season, and burning gas in our homes could potentially make that worse. We also know that more exposure to nitrogen dioxide can impair our immune systems and perhaps even have effects on our hearts due to the inflammatory effects. So there's a whole bunch of terrible things happening within our bodies when we are exposed to gas. And the thing is, too, that even if we're not burning gas in our stoves, we're also exposed to the gas that's leaking from them, even when they're off. Benzene and formaldehyde are two known carcinogens or cancer-causing compounds that leak even when our stoves are off. And the World Health Organization has said that there are no safe levels of exposure to benzene. And I want to mention, just in terms of people's motivation to get gas out of their homes, I took a walk with some friends a couple weeks ago, and they both happened to be doctors. And one of them is an internal medicine doctor. And I'd been talking with them for months, as one does when one's an environmental advocate, about the impacts of climate change on burning gas in homes. But it was really when I sent them information and research about the benzene leakage that they really started to pay attention. And in fact, this led my friend and his wife, who's actually a cancer doctor, to take the gas stove right out of their home, replace it with induction, and in fact decommission their gas fireplaces because they were so concerned about the effects of this cancer-causing chemical, benzene, for their health and their children's health. So I think this is something that hopefully people are increasingly becoming aware of and hopefully can be empowered to act on.
Gas, though, is so ingrained into our homes. This is going to be a huge thing to try and get people to switch from gas to, I'm assuming you're going to say electric for heating. How do you get people on board with this?
You're absolutely right. Right now, over 50% of Canadian households use natural gas in some ways within their homes. And I think what people need to do is be empowered with the information about the health harms and the climate harms of gas, and then also have barriers reduced to switch to healthier all-electric cooking and heating. And so I think one way to convince them is to highlight those health effects, because if you think about it, there are so many different things that we do as parents, as women, to try to help our health, from buying organic food to organic beauty products to the lowest toxin furniture and that sort of thing within our homes. But if you think about it, one of the biggest causes of toxins in our home is the very stove that we cook on. And so I think that would be a big motivator for people to understand the health benefits of switching to electric. And then I think also highlighting the fact that it's a good economic choice. In fact, even all the way down to minus 30 degrees Celsius, air source heat pumps are more efficient and effective than gas, and cheaper than gas, at heating our homes. And that's something that I think the gas industry tries to convince us of, is that it's going to be more expensive. Well, in fact, with rising prices of gas, as more and more homes get off gas because of different climate action measures in this country, the people who are left behind are going to be paying more money. And so I think it's important from both a health and an economic perspective to try to transition towards healthier all-electric homes.
For many listening, though, right now, finances are a big concern, and making these switches, no matter how affordable it is, it's going to cost money to switch. So are there things people can do if they can't afford to retrofit, say, you know, their fireplace or their stove or furnace? Are there things they can do to make the air quality in their house better?
Absolutely. So if you can't afford to make the switch to cleaner electric appliances now, number one, when you use your gas stove, Health Canada, in fact, recommends cooking on the back burners only, turning your range hood up as high as you can, and opening a window. And they say that that's when, in fact, levels of nitrogen dioxide in your kitchen are safe. Now, if you think about it, the weather can get kind of cold in Canada, and having all those things, especially an open window when you're cooking every time, might not be that reasonable. So in fact, it might be better to not use your gas stove at all. So for example, there are really inexpensive induction plates that you can buy, single burner or double burner induction plates, probably cost no more than about $100, that you can use to cook with electricity. So you don't have to use your stove, and it's also more efficient. You can use your microwave. I know for some people that's a dirty word for cooking, but there are a slow cooker, right? Like there are lots of different cooking methods you can use that don't release fossil fuel fumes into our kitchens, even if you do currently have a gas stove and can't afford to switch.
And let's talk about the environmental impact a little bit, because we've really focused on our personal health, but what's the environmental impact of gas stoves, gas fireplaces, furnaces, and so on?
Within cities, so for example, within the city of Vancouver where I live, buildings are responsible for close to 60% of our carbon pollution, and the majority of them comes from natural gas burning. And then, so if you think about that, the fact that we're trying to cut our carbon emissions in half by 2030 and then get to net zero by 2050, we absolutely have to attack the issue of natural gas heating in our homes in order to meet our targets. And I think also as a mother and a physician who is aware of the larger health impacts on the community, think about where the natural gas is coming from. Within Canada, a lot of the gas comes from a process called hydraulic fracturing, which is where you inject huge amounts of water and sand and toxic chemicals under the earth to crack it and release these gas deposits. And there's lots of research showing that communities living nearby these fracking or hydraulic fracturing sites have higher rates of lung disease, have higher rates of heart disease, higher rates of birth defects. So if you think about the fact that when you're turning up your thermostat or turning on your gas stove, that you're having a health impacts on people in these communities where natural gas is extracted, I think that should make us all take pause and think about where our energy is coming from. And I think many of us within Ontario, within BC, across the country, we have experienced the health effects of climate change over the past several years, from the wildfire smoke to the wildfires themselves here on the West Coast, to heat waves and severe flooding. We're seeing the impacts of too much release of carbon into the atmosphere in our everyday lives. And I think if we can try to do our part by doing what we can within our homes, I think that's going to be a good step for a lot of families to take, and a step that really will inspire other people to follow along.
Absolutely. I want people to be able to find out more about this particular topic, but I imagine there are a lot of environmental issues that CAPE is talking about. So where can people find out more?
If you want more information about our gas stove campaign, go to heatcookbreathe.ca. And if you want more information about the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, cape.ca is where you can find us.
All right, wonderful. Thank you for joining me today, Melissa.
Thanks, Candace.
With Candace Sampson and What She Said, coming up on 105.9 The Region. Welcome back to What She Said with Candace Sampson on 105.9 The Region.
And I will always love you.
Family history, as we all know, can be complex, and secrets buried deep within the folds can shape generations. Gwen Harvey, an accomplished entrepreneur turned storyteller, weaves such a narrative in her debut novel, The Acquisition of Elizabeth Grace. Set against the backdrop of England's aristocratic elegance and the stark contrast of Toronto's vibrancy, this novel explores the complex dynamics of mother-daughter relationships, the haunting presence of the past, and the quest for truth. Gwen joins me now to dive into the inspiration behind this compelling coming-of-age story and the journey of uncovering family secrets. Welcome to What She Said, Gwen.
Thank you. Hi, Candace. Thanks for having me.
So you transitioned from business commentary to creative writing. That's quite a leap. So what inspired you to tell the story of the acquisition of Elizabeth Grace?
I lived as a child in England. And as a child in England, when you are writing the composition classes, you're constantly storytelling. So they have composition, grammar, and literature. And so for me, England was always a part of my past and a part of my writing past. So even though I had been in finance and built a family wealth strategy firm, the storytelling side that I had as a child was always there. So the inspiration of the story came from thinking about England a lot, I do. And then also I started having these two little girls running around in my head in these perfect little party dresses, everything's right, and thinking about what turns it upside down. From working in finance and governance with families, if you have a series of bad decision-making, things turn upside down. And it's not just wealth that gets lost, but it's love that's lost, all sorts of things. So those were sort of the mix of personal experience with England, and then also thinking about wealth and thinking about these two little girls running around.
The setting, though, sort of spans, you know, from aristocratic estates to the bustling city of Toronto. So how did these contrasting backdrops influence the narrative?
Very much. Because it's 1960s, it's actually London would have been the hippest city in the world. I think Times Magazine, 1966, said it was. So it was the real it place, very vibrant. And the countryside was, you know, it was vibrant to a degree, but in a different way. Toronto actually back in the 60s was pretty quiet, with vibrant pieces in the neighborhoods, but very different from what we know today. So in the storytelling, how it did impact is definitely when we get into the chapters that are in England, I think there's a little bit more excitement there. And then it's a little more stayed day to day when they're back in Toronto. The researching of the 1960s in Toronto was interesting because I couldn't have them moving into a condominium because they didn't have them yet. And apartment buildings.
That's true.
Well, they were small, you know, things like that.
Well, the disappearance of Elizabeth Grace is a real pivotal moment for her daughters, Sophie and Olivia. Can you share more about how this event sets the stage for their journey and the themes you wanted to explore through their experience?
Those are great questions. It happens early in the book where she disappears. They're age 8 and 10. And the girls, that loss of someone so important, but then trying to define it in your own terms. And the two daughters define the going away of their mother in different ways. One in a sense of she's probably not coming back. The other one thinking she's going to come back at any time. So I think it's just the mother-daughter relationships, the feelings that there are between different people and how they hang on to them. And then over time, as they seek to reunite and find their mother and figure out what happened, again, just their differences in handling it. So perhaps the themes of loss and love, but also of how we are different from each other and how we interpret things, how things themselves are not as they seem. That's a constant piece that keeps coming up. The protagonist goes through changes, and you watch and feel her go through those changes as she perceives things differently.
And the uncovering of family secrets is a central theme in the book. What do you hope readers take away from the sisters' journey of discovery and then reconciliation with their past?
These are thought-provoking questions. I would hope readers would take away, actually on the mother-daughter side, is that I think often daughters think their mother should be perfect, and then they start finding out they're not perfect. And so maybe if they looked inside why and learned to understand them better, they could figure that out, and it would help everybody be closer, which I think we eventually do. You know, I'm in my 60s and I understand my 90-year-old mother now, but I'm not sure when that happened. Was it in my 50s or 40s or 30s? Probably not my 20s. So that would be a piece of a theme. And I think, So, and I'm looking forward to my daughter reading the book and finding her reaction. She hasn't read it yet. So it's not out. It's coming.
So this is your debut novel. Did you have challenges in bringing the world of Harrington Hall and its characters to life?
It's actually my second novel. It's the first novel that I
publisher
for. I self-published a novel during COVID. That's when I wrote my first one. It's called The Girlfriend Book, and it's about three women over three decades. And it's certainly, I've had a lot of great reaction to that book about those relationships of friendships over time. And then I was just so lucky when I submitted this to Rebooks and they picked it up. It's the only I only sent it into one publisher because a friend said they were taking submissions. So it's a bit magical. So I'm probably not answering your question. So it has been a completely different ride to be having a publisher, the support you have. It's lovely to discuss the characters with someone else. They rattle around in your own head, you know.
Well, I ask most authors this when they join me on the show, and I'm going to assume you're going to answer like they do. Do you have another book in the works already?
Yes, I have a finished first draft of a third novel, but it's not finished. It's a thriller. It's about stolen identity. And I just know there's lots of work to do on the characters, but I have at least an idea of where the story is going. And it is not necessarily going to end the way I have it right now. But so I guess I have a draft. But I'm looking forward to getting back to that. Probably it will be in the summer that I sort of miss the writing.
Well, I'm looking forward to diving into the acquisition of Elizabeth Grace. I encourage people to hop on over and follow what she said on Instagram if you're not already, because at some point we are going to be giving away these books when I share it there. So in the meantime, where can people get the book, follow along with you, and keep up with you on social media?
Thank you. The book is online, or you can order it through your local bookstore either way. So you can find it on Amazon or through a local bookstore. You can follow me on my website, which is gwenkharvey.com. And you can subscribe there if you want to follow along on the journey. I have a monthly piece that comes out to describe it, lots of pictures and characters. And then I also have an Instagram account, which is at Gwen K. Harvey.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. I feel the need to go get a scone right now. So thank you, Gwen. We'll have you back again soon.
Thank you so much.
Beside the victory that's a destiny.
Life is full of challenges that test our resilience and determination. For teenagers, navigating the complexities of adolescence can be particularly daunting, especially when fear of failure looms large, paralyzing their willingness to try new things or take risks. It's a critical period where the support and guidance of parents can make a significant difference in helping teens overcome their fears and embrace life's opportunities with confidence. In this next interview, Allie Payne, What She Said's expert on parenting teens, joins me to share ways you can help your teens navigate fear of failure. Welcome back to the show, Allie.
Thank you so much for having me.
So many teens, especially today, seem more anxious and risk averse than previous generations. In your experience, what are the main factors contributing to this heightened fear of failure among teenagers?
First is us as parents. And this is what feels like the biggest slap in the face. So if you're listening, please, 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 this is not judgment or shame. Our generation was sort of the raise yourself generation, right? And we were left to figure stuff out on our own, and it could have been very painful and a lot of pitfalls and mistakes that some of them had long-term consequences in our lives. So the statistics on our generation is we are now becoming the rescue generation. So we are raising our children in a way that is rescuing them or at least padding them from a lot of these harder experiences or even simply experiencing challenging emotions like exclusion, failure, struggle, those kinds of things. So you might be calling your child's coach to make sure that they're on the get on the team. You might be calling their teachers to see if there's a way that they can get through just to get them to pass, which again, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm just saying our generation as this rescue me generation, or another way to say it is sort of the helicopter parent or the lawnmower parent that's just, or the snowplow parent. We're paving the way a little bit, right. Even in micro ways, to have our children not experience trying and failing, challenge, struggle, not getting what they want, and being in really uncomfortable, challenging feelings. So that is a really big part of this that feels like a slap in the face, because it's like, well, thanks, Allie. Here I am. breaking cycles, just being a loving parent. And now you're telling me I've sucked at that too. I know that's what you're hearing. It's not what I'm saying. God bless you for wanting to love your child. So there's that. There's also, this is where I think social media plays into a little bit of this, because heaven forbid, if I grew up when there was social media, I would be unemployed. I don't know. Because if every single thing that you do, every moment of your life, including the struggle, has an opportunity to make it onto thousands of screens because somebody happened to capture it or do a snap video of it or something when you were taking the foul shot in basketball and you missed both, and then somebody posts that and says, you know, there's this amplified experience of a need to be perfect because these teens are growing up in a place where their whole life is posted for public view. And so there's that little portion of it. And please don't make up that any one of these is, I don't know, necessarily bigger than the other. These are just all factors. And a third one, and this is huge, is here you are again, you're raising your child and you are reminding them of their potential because you of all people, you're their parent, you see it. Yay. But if you just saw yourself the way I saw you, and if you just did this a little bit different, you would be like, you'd make the team. If you just did this, you could get A's. And if you just did that, blah, blah, blah. So what happens is your teenager is hearing about all the ways they're falling short. And this is, again, the way that you and I were probably raised, is that criticism was the greatest motivator. Criticism, the guilt trip, retaliation was like the motivator for our parents. And what we know psychologically is actually that is the biggest demotivator, is pointing out where your child, the line that they are living and the line of their potential. And you are just constantly pointing out the gap of a reality that's never been proven. It's just this dream version of their life you have in their mind and where they're falling short of that. So we're constantly demotivating them. So then they're not going to try because all they hear is ways they're falling short, even though in your mind, you don't know, maybe they did fail, but maybe they were actually trying their best on that, but they're not going to tell you because it's so painful. So, and I think the fourth way is this, is that it doesn't seem inherently, it doesn't seem normal to raise a child where you are telling them all the ways you failed. Like that kind of seems like, what? Like I need them to know I'm a parent. I need them to know, you know, it's not about necessarily hiding anything. It's not what I'm saying. It's just, it seems weird to make a point of telling your child all the ways you failed. Because what if they don't, what if it's a fall from grace in their eyes? Like what if they don't see you that way? I'm going to tell you for free. Your child, as much as they think they say they hate your guts, they don't want anything to do with you. They think you're perfect. They think you got to where you got and didn't fail ever. You didn't struggle. You didn't fail. You didn't try and it didn't go well. You didn't get fired. You didn't fail. Nothing. Because how would they know? They weren't that part of your life. So when you don't do that, because I understand it just seems weird, they perpetuate the story that they are always falling short of you because you didn't fail or struggle and they are. So those are probably the four biggest reasons that I see happening. And again, some of them are proven in studies of why kids are just more afraid of trying anything.
So what are some practical steps then? I mean, I'm sure parents were listening to this and heard themselves, you know, in what you were just saying and see themselves and their teens. So what are some practical steps parents can take to help their teens build resilience and a healthier attitude towards failure?
So make dinner time the time where you throw yourself under the bus. This was one of the greatest things that I'm glad I did. And I actually did it more to help my son with sports, but also prepare him for university and how different it is from high school. And his dad and I started sharing all these stories about how we wildly failed. And we had the most laughter and fascinating conversations by being willing to share our failures and struggles and what we learned and what we wish had gone different and what would never have gone different because we just did our best. That was one, normalize failure and struggle. Normalize because scientifically, you cannot learn anything until you fail at it first. So you can try and undo the science of it, but that's not going to work. You must fail first. So if we don't normalize failure, then our child is just never going to want to learn. The next thing is there's a lot of studies on performance-based praise and effort-based praise. And children who are only acknowledged and praised based on their outcome and their effort, their performance, like grades, for instance, actually become more demotivated over time because of an increase in anxiety of whether or not they can repeat that result. Children who are praised only on their effort, they were creative, you made the time, I see that you made that, like, I got, that was hard, you struggled at that, I saw how you thought that way through. That is actually the most motivating praise. It builds resilience in children's confidence because it normalizes failure in a way at the same time and honors effort or over performance. The next thing is I want you to affirm what your child is doing right. I need you to let go of this whole potential gap. If I was drawing a diagram of the dream version of their life, which is not true, it's a something you have in your mind. And by the way, it might not be the dream that they have for their life. I understand you see their potential. This is their potential. You got it. You're not letting go of that dog on a boat. They're going down here. And all you want to do, because that's what we were raised to believe, is your job is to point out where they're falling short. I need you to stop that. I need you to acknowledge the line they're on, because scientifically, no one will ever try anything unless they feel validated, seen, heard, and appreciated for where they're at. Now, you might be like, well, I don't appreciate my children getting a D and an F. And I'm not going to be a crappy parent and validate that. I got it. How's it working for you now? So you can either say, I love you. Your grades are not who you are. And you start seeing your child for who they are and affirming character traits. And also so for who they are as effort-based praise. The fourth thing that is critical is go do something together that you either suck at or you've never done either. Show them how it's okay to try and not like something and fail at it and have fun anyway. Model that for your child. And that invites them to the safety of trying, which builds confidence, which is resilience.
Great advice, as usual. I think a lot of times, I mean, I remember thinking my parents were just born parents. And yeah. It's hard to visualize your parents as kids. So I love this advice. It's great. And if people, you know, saw themselves or their teens anywhere in this conversation, I really want them to reach out and connect with you. So where's the best place for them to do that, Allie? Because I know you talk about this very thing a lot on your website and in your coaching with parents.
Absolutely. So they can find me on TikTok and Instagram at Allie Payne, AllyPain, or my website, AllyPain.com.
All right. Incredible. Allie, we'll see you in a couple of months. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
That's it for What She Said this week. Stay up to date with our newsletter by signing up at WhatSheSaidTalk.com and be sure to follow on social at What She Said Talk on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for videos of these interviews and more. You can also catch me on TikTok at Candace Said. Finally, be sure to subscribe to What She Said with Candace Sampson on Apple and Spotify to catch past episodes and extended podcasts. I'll be back next week with another What She Said on 105.9 The Region.
Previous episodes of What She Said on 105.9theregion.com.